My motto is I like to kind of alleviate suffering a little bit. I think it makes me feel good to make people happy. So whether that is laughing with me or at me, I would love to laugh with you. But if it's at my expense, it's okay. As long as I made your day a little bit better.
Welcome to another episode of the Hey, Where'd You Go podcast. I'm your host, Colin Kushner. The goal of Hey, Where'd You Go is to catch up with former prep, collegiate, and professional athletes showcasing what they're doing today. This week's guest, in my humble opinion, is the most interesting man to ever play in the National Football League. He played college football at the University of Michigan, went on to play for the New England Patriots in the NFL, and now he's currently an account executive at Snowflake, which is a cloud-based data warehousing company. All right, now we have Zoltan Mesko. Zoltan has his dad joke PhD.
This is true. Yeah, I appreciate you saving that content until I could genuinely react to it. But yes, I have terrible jokes to tell, usually.
You know what, to start things off, dude, let's start it off on a lighthearted note. Let's hear your best dad joke if you have one off the top of your head.
It's very impromptu, so it's not like I have a lot of them. And now I'm trying to like gloss through my dictionary of dad jokes, but they're not coming to me. So maybe I'll pepper them in as they come to me throughout this conversation.
Zoltan, I want to start from the very beginning of your life. You have such a compelling backstory. You were born in 1986 in Timișoara, Romania, right in the height of communism. And a couple of years later, the Romanian Revolution took place. And I know you were just a little kid, but do you remember anything from that time?
As far as remembering, maybe my mind decided to have selective amnesia there because I was only 3.5 years old when that whole regime got thrown over in kind of the holiday season of 1989. So now 31 years ago. But from the standpoint of like hearing the stories day in, day out, and then I could say, okay, well, I was technically a part of that, just never really remember it. It's quite eye-opening to where I've come from. Of course, I always forget my roots. You know, people do say, never forget your roots. I mean, can't really operate under always remembering stuff. But yeah, it's good to reflect back on where I've come from such a terrible time in kind of a second world, I'll call it, country.
Did your parents ever discuss or did you ever kind of ask them about life under a communist regime before you were born?
Yeah, I think that's the biggest, piece that's kind of eye-opening to people. So both my parents are fairly educated. They're both engineers. My dad went to that master's level in postgraduate schooling, but both engineers. And, you know, it's very eye-opening to people to imagine that they were both, each making $100 a month. And that's not exaggerating. And food may have cost just slightly below what it costs here, as far as that shopping cart index that they use to kind of gauge consumer index something. And gas for our car was costing about the equivalent of $9 per gallon. So, of course, our car was sitting in the parking lot most of the time. It was only used for like emergencies. Oh, it's raining. Let me take the kid to school rather than have him myself walk, you know, a mile or two to school when I was in, first, second grade. And funny enough, just another example of communism is that my parents put down that car payment, 100% down payment on that car. And 5 years later, they received the car. So that's how communism works, basically. And, you have to kind of fine tune stuff once you got the car because no one really cared. There was no competition to make a good product. So once you got that car, you had to kind of tighten up the bolts so then it wouldn't fall apart if you drove over 40 miles an hour, let's say.
So you're not even getting a complete vehicle, really. You wait that long and there's...
Yeah. You're getting like a Ford Pinto, the thing that exploded if you got rear-ended. Do you remember that thing?
I do. I do remember that.
Yeah, but very much, no air conditioning car. There's a story, that I tell a lot with my mom when I was a one-year-old. It was my first birthday. She went out to the egg store, like specific egg store. There was no supermarkets, with her little like coupon, like, you know, you could get like 2 dozen eggs for the month. And then they would check you off the list, like, all right, that's your quota for the month. She picked that up. She waited in line for 3 hours. She got the eggs. She was jogging home, tripped on the curb, and smashed the eggs as she was falling. So she cried for another like 3 hours after 3 hours of waiting. So that's kind of like giving you an idea of like what they had to endure, right?
That's crazy to think about, because it's the simplest of tasks, right? Going to get eggs, you know, like you said, right now, nowadays, you go to the supermarket, you go in, unless you go to Trader Joe's, you're going to wait a while, but you wait 5 minutes, you grab it, you're out. Same with a car. You purchase a car, you get the vehicle that day, you drive it off the lot, and it's complete.
Not to dive too deep into the human philosophy or psychology, but, you know, we adapt fairly quickly, even on mentality's sake. And, you know, to me, it's like as if it never happened. And I'm sure with my parents as well, right? They use the same Instacart services of today. But, you know, 30 years ago, they were doing that, you know, waiting in line at the egg store for 3 hours. Pretty ridiculous.
Was the goal for your parents to get you guys to the United States, or just get out of Romania in general?
Yeah, just get out in general. So we have some like German lineage or whatever, genetics. So they tried to prove out like, all right, if we can, you know, prove out to this Romanian government, and this was after communism, because you were not allowed to leave Romania, right? If you had to leave, you had to run across the border and get shot. Technically, that was the risk. So Nadia Comăneci, who was a Olympian gold medalist gymnast, did that. I believe she went to some, I don't know the full story, but I believe she fled with her husband or then fiance or something. But yeah, you literally had to flee. And, you know, there was tons of more stories like that. You know, funny enough, you speak of the weather in Cleveland. So our heating in Romania under communism was not turned on until after the Thanksgiving timeframe. So you were wearing 2 to 3 sweaters in a, you know, 40, high 40s, low 50s degree apartment, right? Which is ridiculous. You had one channel, right? That came on 1 hour a night. You got 40 minutes of like propaganda news, then 10 minutes of weather, and then 10 minutes of cartoons. So of course that's when my parents were like stuffing food in my face, because I was paying attention to the cartoons. But even from the standpoint of cooking, you had these propane tanks that you got one a month. My grandfather, who was not of the communist ideology, actually joined the Communist Party just kind of as a eavesdropper, like, if I hear any like anti-speak against this regime, I honor, you know, to report these people, right, to whistleblow. And he got a second tank of propane to cook and heat the house with before that Thanksgiving surge of energy, right? So obviously he never reported anyone. He was just like, yeah, just give it to me. I'll join, yep. But yeah, that's how you kind of had to get along. And, you know, jeans, you couldn't get jeans. You have to go through kind of like connections and kind of the black market to get blue jeans, right? It's ridiculous.
It puts so much into perspective, you know, for a guy like me. I was born and raised in Southern California, where, you know, like we talked about, if you want to go get eggs, you go to the market. If you want jeans, you go on oldnavy.com or wherever you want and buy them. It really puts things in life in perspective, because those little things we take for granted now because it's so easy. Growing up there, post-communism, sports a big part of your life out there? Like, what was that scene? What did that look like?
I think there was a big emphasis put on sports, funny enough, with a communist regime. I mean, sports in general is kind of like your marketing arm, right? Even at a university, like, why are sports emphasized so much? Because they actually drive enrollment, and enrollment drives demand. So yes, my dad was a good, you know, fairly realistic fanatic, not like crazy blind, but he kind of instilled that love of sports in me, and kind of looking up to your, you know, sports heroes and, yeah, I guess one day trying to become like them and all that good stuff. But yeah, there was, you know, saw plenty of soccer, saw plenty of rugby. Obviously, soccer is the religion in Europe, and it was in Romania as well. So grew up around that sport.
And then where does football factor into all this? Because it doesn't seem, I don't believe that Romania was going crazy over football, particularly University of Michigan football.
Right, right. No, I saw some highlights. Again, this was post-communism, so post-1989. It was, you know, I saw some highlights. Oh, they played the Super Bowl yesterday, and it was like a 15-second clip of, like, you know, someone, like, ripping the other person's head off. And I was like, oh, that's pretty violent. So that's all I knew about football until I came to the U.S. But then I got acquainted to it. I saw that there was a part where you kick the ball, and I was like, maybe I can transfer these soccer skills to football.
You never wanted to be the guy that was decapitating somebody else, right?
There are certain times, even today, where I do want to, you know, get a little angry with work. But no, of course, on a day-to-day basis, I was never that kind of aggressive. But yeah, I just found it very intriguing that there was a kicking aspect to it. There was a skill involved. And of course, there's skill involved in all aspects, all positions of football. So to me, you know, that only came later, that realization.
When you and your family emigrated to the United States, you all ended up in New York City to start and then moved to Twinsburg, Ohio. When you first came to the States, what was your mindset? Were you like, what is going on? Was it excitement? You know, what were the range of emotions during that time? Because you were about 11 years old, I think.
So we first arrived in Queens, right? One of the, I guess, segments of New York City, right? Greater New York City. And it was in 97, and my family came over here through a green card lottery. Funny enough, my dad applied for it because he always played the monetary lottery. So he's like, why don't I, you know, the U.S. government is giving out like 55,000 green cards. So we applied to that, and out of 20 million applicants, we were chosen. So I think that's like a, I don't know, I've calculated it before. It's like a 0.027 or 4 something percentage. So I consider myself lucky. Of course, yes, I, you know, I won some sort of a sperm lottery as well in the beginning, but I consider myself lucky to be in the States and be realizing the American dream. But to your question of, you know, kind of the a little bit of a shock factor that we went into in New York was that Queens wasn't what it is today. In New York City, you could easily, you know, listen to about 3 murders being listed off on the nightly news. So my mom was like, wow, this is terrible. Like in her Eastern European accent, she said, this is worse than communism. So she threatened to move back. She's like, this is crazy. But a family that came the year before us landed in Cleveland, Ohio, and they're like, hey, like, there's much more bang for your buck out here. Like you can live in the suburbs. You don't need to live in New York City or whatever, where your dollar doesn't go that far. And, you know, we ended up packing our U-Haul and getting out to Cleveland, Ohio. And, you know, I find myself here today, you know, what, 23 years later.
That's amazing. It is difficult though, when you move from a place, communism, post-communism, then you come to the States and you're free, yet, you know, you hear about the turmoil, like you said, in New York City at that time. And you're like, wait a second. I left my native country to come here.
I knew America from, funny enough, movies, like including Rambo and Ninja Turtles. From that standpoint, you know, even post-communism, I forgot to mention, you know, we thought life was going to be fine and dandy, like not having a dictator. But what ended up happening was hyperinflation set in. To the point of, like, you know, we were all millionaires in our local, you know, monetary figures, but your dollar or your, you know, your local money, which was called the leu or the lei, Romanian lei, didn't go that far, right? So you had access to all these products now. You know, I mentioned you didn't have access to blue jeans before and you only had rations. Now you did have access, but you didn't have enough money. to spend it. So that's where I went back to kind of how I started it with both of my parents being engineers, but only earning the equivalent of $100 a month each, right? So that's part of the reason why we came to America, right? And we're trying to desperately get out of there, period. Whether it was going to be Germany, which we couldn't prove that we were 25% German lineage. And then my dad kind of serendipitously won that green card lottery.
In regards to settling down in the Cleveland suburbs, then did someone present football to you? Because you told me about how you watched that 15-second ad. Or where does football factor into this? You're new to the U.S. And then was that something that came right away?
It was in, I think, eighth grade gym class. You know, the gym teacher, phys ed teacher, decided to play kickball that one day. And it was, you know, baseball combined. You know, I didn't even know, like, I did know some of the rules of baseball. Of course, I was Indians fan growing up. As soon as I had picked it up, like, all right, what are the rules? But really didn't see the combination before. And, you know, someone just told me, like, you know, aim for the rafters over there. That's a home run. And I was like, all right, I'll go up there. And of course, like, ball came bouncing awkwardly, and I struck the ball, and it hit one of the gym lights and like exploded it, and people had to run. I may have done it on purpose, just for, that was my foul ball. And then the gym teacher came up to me after that, and it's like, all right, so you either have like the option of paying for that light, or we're losing our kicker on the varsity football team, so if you could kick for us, that would also pay for it. The rest is history from, you know, eighth grade and on.
That's an amazing story. You take out the light and they're like, hey, Zoltan, you're either going to pay for this or you're going to come kick for us. Was it ever a question in your mind what you were going to do?
Yeah, of course it was tongue in cheek. Sorry, right, I interrupted. But, you know, to me, I saw the attendance of soccer attendees, you know, it was friends and family. And I saw Friday Night Lights in America, especially in the state of Ohio and California and Florida and Texas, you know, pretty major football and attendance and interest in high school football. So I saw a couple thousand people and I was like, holy crap. And look, there's cheerleaders. That's awesome. Like, so I already knew what I was getting into. I was like, yeah, that could be me. Yeah.
Well, now we know why you did it. You did it for the cheerleaders. It all makes sense now, dude.
All about the cheerleaders. So. Never let anyone tell you that they don't change the game.
Yeah. Oh man, that's amazing. So you start kicking, and your first experience jumping out in a game situation with with tons of fans and the pageantry. Did you take a second to kind of soak that in?
I think I was already, I was too reactive in the moment, like didn't take too much of a proactive stance at it. I only learned after on how to kind of calm myself down. But I think the first or second game, I had the urge of puking. That's how nervous I became, right? As a freshman, funny enough, I was like 6'3", 150 pounds. So soaking wet. Every 10 yards, I had to pull up my football pants because like, my butt wasn't big enough.
And your parents, were they nervous at all though for you to play football? Because it's such a physical sport, but when you present yourself as a punter and a kicker, I feel like that's like your easy street to play in.
Yeah. I mean, it goes hand in hand with me mentioning that I was a twig, right? 6'3", 150. And my mom's like, again, in her Eastern European accent, no, you're going to die. Like, no, mom, I'm going to kick the ball. But yeah, once in a while you get hit as the kicker as well, or the punter. But yeah, it's, you know, after I convinced her that I wasn't playing a collision position, then it was, you know, welcomed by her.
And when you started having success on the football field, did that come as a surprise? Or is that something that after, you know, booting that ball up into the rafters or in kickball, where you kind of anticipated something like that?
So I wouldn't say like I was really good at kicking my freshman year in high school. The big magnitude of jump in power and a little bit of skill refinement in kicking the ball came from my freshman to sophomore year when I discovered the weight room and I dedicated myself. And funny enough, I gained 55 pounds freshman to sophomore year. So you know, I was then became 6'3", 205.
You gained 55 pounds?
55 pounds.
And all that protein powder.
all that protein powder. And funny enough, like I just stuffed my face until, you know, it reached the esophagus.
Wow. I mean, I think I was impressed with myself when I was playing hockey that I gained 15 pounds from sophomore to junior year of high school. But you totally just took a crap on that with the 55 pounds gain.
Yeah, it's just like I was very like back. So like there was lots to be gained back, right? It's not like I was the average 6'3" person. So there was a big frame, you know, and the first time I had ever gone out of, I'll call it homeostasis, right? Never having lifted before.
Did anyone ever look at you, the coaching staff, as someone to play on defense or a quarterback? Because although I know you were small your freshman year, but didn't they ever look at you and say, we don't want you to kick, we want you to do this?
Funny enough, you're hitting all the right notes in chronological order. When they saw me at, you know, 205, they're like, oh, hey, would you like to try tight end and defensive end? I was like, all right. I guess I'm like big enough to take a hit. And funny enough, my mentality, like I was never there to like collide every practice. And that's, you know, way back in the day when you had to do like two-a-days and, you know, hit every single day. And by the time I got to week 5 out of a 10-week high school football regular season, I was like, guys, I can't do this. Call me whatever you want to call me, but I'm just going to focus on kicking. And that was a blessing in disguise because the opportunity cost, you know, I was doing very well. You know, I mentioned I took a leap in skill level and strength. That was, you know, a big leap. And, you know, it allowed me to be whatever first team all conference that year as a punter kicker. That I was kind of like, if I focus on this, you know, tight end defensive end thing, like it's not going to happen. And funny enough, I didn't like getting hit. I didn't like hitting. I always thought you had to lead with your head. So I constantly got headaches. So ibuprofen was part of my diet. And then funny enough, I was a straight A student in high school, except for one class that I took in the fall of my sophomore year, which is when I was playing defensive end tight end. And that was like, you know, hindsight 2020, that's like, right, it does kind of affect your cognitive ability a little bit.
It's amazing that you had the foresight, so to speak, to understand, because it's easy to go off what your coaches say, hey, you're huge. We want you to play quarterback, tight end, defensive end, whatever. And I think it's great that you just said, hey, listen, I'm not digging this. I want to focus on kicking and perfecting that craft. I don't know. I don't really know many high school kids that kind of just go in there and just say, hey, nope, I'm doing this. I want to make this it.
Well, that's the thing, right? I had the stance, the kind of, let's call it the leverage or the negotiation stance where I could say that, right? It's like, well, are you okay with me providing you the best punting and kicking in the conference? Of course, like you're not going to kick me off the team, right? My last game in my freshman year in high school, I discovered that someone could get college paid for playing football, especially kicking an oblong leather object through uprights or punting it, a spiral, right? I was like, oh my God, that's when I dedicated myself. I was going to say like the motivation to gain all that weight. And funny enough, I didn't have the goal of gaining 55 pounds. I was just like, I was literally when, you know, my parents took me to Catholic mass, I would pray like, oh, please let me get to 170. And when I reached 170 in like 2 to 3 weeks, I was like, please let me get to 180. And I was like, oh, how high can I take this? Right.
You topped out at 205.
right. Yeah. Yeah. So. But by my senior year in high school, I got to like the 240 range. So
that's so funny. I feel like I did the same thing back in high school. You know, I'd go to Temple and I'd be like, man, I'm 4'11", 112. Like, can I please get to 120? Got to 120. Can I please get to 123? And then that was it.
Yeah. And you know, if you want to go down that path, like, I feel like, you know, any type of faith I might have had back then, I kind of look down upon it because it's like I really used it as a rabbit's foot rather than like, hey, there's more to this than you know, asking what you want, what you seemingly think you want. But that's another, maybe another conversation for another day. But if you want to dive down the rabbit hole, be my friend, be my guy.
We can dive down. Well, we have lots of rabbit holes that we have to cover. We have faith. We also have dad jokes. Cause people say, I'm not even a dad. I'm not even married.
I still don't have anything in my head.
It's all good. It has to be natural. I get made fun of all the time for having dad jokes and people are like, those are not funny. I said, dad jokes, it's the best type of humor. And I put a period at the end of that too.
My motto is, I like to kind of alleviate suffering a little bit. I think it makes me feel good to make people happy. So whether that is laughing with me or at me, I would love to laugh with you, but if it's at my expense, it's okay. As long as I made your day a little bit better. Like, I feel like just giving in general makes the majority of humans feel good.
I agree, especially now. I mean, you think about what we're in now in the middle of this pandemic. I mean, you can't even see people's faces, you know, but you could just tell, like, if you look into somebody's eyes, you could tell what's happening. And it's terrible. And to your point, if you can make someone smile or laugh for a second to alleviate that, I think that's huge. And I have a similar thing. I tell people if I can make one person laugh or smile per day, I've done my job. A lot of people think that's a very low bar, but I don't think it is, because it takes one person and then maybe they get inspired and then that kind of channels out.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I love that viewpoint. And I wish I could be reminded of it every day. Maybe I'll put a piece of paper up there. Just, you know, it's free to smile and be nice. And I think to that extent, you mentioned the pandemic, but I also think like it extends into the political divide that we have today, you know, with the polarization of views. And honestly, like, you know, and the cream of the crap rises to the top on Twitter and social media and whatnot. So that sucks, because it really doesn't represent the majority of the voices, but kind of the small little subset of voices get kind of retweeted and liked to the top. So you think, oh, everyone believes this. But when you get into a conversation like that, you know, going back to like giving, like just give your attention, give your open-mindedness a little bit. Like, I'm not saying you have to be convinced, just kind of like listen to each other. A lot of the stuff would be alleviated.
I love that, especially now, but not even just, I don't want to put a focus on now. It should be taken, pandemic or not, whatever's happening in the political arena, that your approach is great. And I think that'll serve tons of people in a positive way, and people that you won't even know that you made an impact with. Were you a goofball on the football team?
I was a goofball in general, like kind of the class clown. And I think, you know, some of it has served me well. Funny enough that, you know, this self-reflection had to happen. So I like the entertainment part, you know, even joking with, you know, the most serious people out there, like a Bill Belichick or a Lloyd Carr, or, you know, once you get comfortable and you know, like you can push those buttons and it's like, you know, nothing bad will happen. I tend to push those buttons, but of course, like sometimes there's times where you need to be serious, and I've kind of started to, separate those two, which is a good thing. Some of the self-awareness, kind of like, oh, you shouldn't have said a joke while that serious topic was being discussed, you know, like, but yeah, hey, we're human, we learn, and as long as we're self-aware, that's fine.
I'm just like you. I've slowly been learning over the years how to channel, okay, Colin, this is an appropriate time to say something funny. Hey, Colin, this is not an appropriate time to say something. It's a challenge.
Yeah. I mean, even my wife tells me, like, hey, here was the line. You jumped over it. Like, didn't even pull it. You jumped over it. Yeah. But is it okay if I jump right back? Like,
I think so. I think if you jump over and then you have a 5-second window, this is just my theory, Zoltan. So take it.
Yeah.
You jump back, you're good. That negates everything.
Yes. Yeah. I've come up with a term for that, by the way, just kind of like, hey, how about five second travel, time travel machine? Okay. Forget about what I said.
Oh man, that's awesome. I want to hear more about you trying to make Bill Belichick laugh. I feel like those stories, are great, but first I kind of want to go back to, I want to go to the recruiting trail. You were recruited by Michigan, obviously, Ohio State, USC, and a few other schools. why Michigan over Ohio State? You're living in Ohio. Everyone loves the Scarlet and Gray.
Yeah. And funny enough, I was a huge, huge Ohio State fan to the point of like my freshman year in high school, they won the national championship against the Hurricanes, right? I was a huge Ohio State fan and I saw that double overtime victory. I was wearing my Ohio State, Christmas present, Mesco 15 jersey. That was my high school number in high school.
You had a Mesco. I have to hang up the call on that. You had a Mesco Ohio State jersey. Oh no. Yeah. No.
And then the way I got recruited by Michigan was I had laid out 14 different camps that I was going to go to and showcase my kicking abilities. And my mom was like, "Hey, you do know that like," and she was all about academics all the time. "You do know that Michigan has a camp coming up. So do you want to sign up?" And I was like, "Yeah, I mean, as much of a bigot as I was, let's call it, like, you know, blind faith fanatic of Ohio State, still there was that little seed in me where I was giving the respect to them, right, to the Michigan. And while I was saying, oh, you know, screw Michigan, I always had that respect. And when I went up to their camp, of course, Ohio State that year did not need a punter. So sadly, I did, I was kind of like, well, I'm not going to Ohio State, I guess. And then I went to Michigan's camp and Mike DeBoard, who was the special teams coach, used to be the offensive coordinator back in that national championship year, but he was special teams coach at that time. And he's like, "Hey, so you're from Ohio. Who do you like, Ohio State or Michigan?" And I was like, both.
That's a fantastic answer.
Yes. Yeah. I'm really neutral. But yeah, I mean, after that camp, I had a really good camp. I came out as the number one ranked punter and they needed a punter. I knew that. I kind of, did that analysis beforehand and accepted the offer from Lloyd Carr a couple of days later. And funny enough, 2 hours later, Jim Tressel from Ohio State called me and said, "Hey, we have an offer for you. Would you like to stay in Ohio and punt for the Buckeyes?" And I was like, I was looking at my high school football coach who was college roommates with Jim Tressel.
Wow.
And he's like, "Don't do it. You already gave your word to Michigan." And I was like, "Really? But..."
You're like, "But I can just take my Mesco 15 Ohio State jersey. They don't even have to give me a new one."
Right. I'm like, "Can I just pull this over my shoulder pads?" And yeah, I decided to, go with my first choice. And I viewed it as a really like foolproof plan, because if football never worked out, and of course that's a low probability play, the academic side would, because, I took a tour of their business school. And of course you still had to apply once you were a Michigan student to get into it, but it was still a top 10 program. And I was like, this is great. And I think, Michigan has 105 programs or, degree fields that are in the top 10, ranked in the top 10, right? So that was kind of just mind-boggling to me. I was like, that's a great university. National TV exposure potentially, right? If I started and all that good stuff. And yeah, I was quite comfortable with the choice. Of course, my friends were not so comfortable. I got a good amount of crap for it, but that's okay.
I just find it hysterical that your high school coach, roommates with Jim Tressel, looks at you and says, "You gave your word to Michigan." That is true. There is something to be said for your word. I just think the rivalry is so heightened, and in the spotlight, everyone just thinks it's...
Yeah. Well, just to show you what a good person he is, right? Because it's like, even now, like when I graduated Michigan, I was such a big like fan of them and still am. But now I hang my hat more on the academic side, the research part of the university, right? Like, anytime someone gives me crap about, how bad the football team is, it's like, okay, well, you're very welcome for the polio vaccine made available through the University of Michigan, right? So that's kind of like the prideful thing, the control, the really the things that you can control in life are the things like, you know, your intellectual self, right? Your academic side.
How do you stress the importance, I should say, of the academic side of things? Because if you're a top recruit, or if you're just getting recruited in general, it's like football, 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 and all the cool things that come with it. And I feel like there's very little conversation about, if you go to the University of Michigan and you want to study business, you have the Ross School of Business, a top program in the country. I feel like there are very little conversations that go that avenue, and it's always football or athletics focused.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, as a youngster, like I always looked at, you know, the potential to play professionally. Of course, I got more and more realistic about it as I, you know, went through my Michigan days. But I guess you emphasize the academics to people that it matters to, right? If it's important to them. It's not important to everyone. And honestly, like, you can get a good degree. Like, a degree is just like you don't need to go to Harvard to get a good job. Like, right, even if you go to any Big Ten school, you're going to have an amazing alumni base. And I don't care if you go to freaking ITT Tech. Like, it's how you apply yourself. That's really what the mental transition I've come to. And of course, you know, a lot of people, let's say, get their MBAs from Harvard Business School or Stanford, right? For the network. It's not that, oh, I can build financial models so much better. No, it's like, I know who to call and I know who to trust because I spent 2 years with this person and I know he's not a schmuck, or he or she, right? And you build your network. It's all about the network and the alumni base, right?
I guess my question is, how do you convince somebody the importance of applying yourself? I think that's a better way to put it, as opposed to going and getting your degree and then hanging it up on the wall, because you could have a law degree and it could just sit there. If you apply yourself though, that's a completely different, those are two different things.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think it's, well, you have to center it around people's passion. And, you know, I use that word term loosely. It's like, what are you curious about, right? That you can't like put down, where, you know, you work through the day and you forget to eat lunch, right? For me, that's like building stuff. I love, even if it's Photoshop, if it's woodworking, like I'll just be like, I'll look up from my computer screen or like from the garage and I'm like, oh, I gotta eat, you know? So like you find that thing and then you base your messaging around that. Like, well, you like design? We have a top 5 design program that, you know, we'll put in a good word, where it's not a guarantee, but of course, in today's recruiting, it's probably a guarantee. But who knows? I'm speaking out of turn or out of line. I guess you couple it with what people's desires are, right? You know, even I'm in selling now, right? I'm in sales. You have to peel the onion back, but you have to start with the importance to the prospect, the client, right? What's most important to you? Because if I go off on a tangent and tell you all about my product, who cares, right? Like, just simple stuff. Like, you know, what's important to you about interviewing people? Well, I really hope they like open up and they tell me like genuine stories and they get really, you know, vulnerable with me, because I feel like that makes for great content. Okay, how do we recruit more people like that?
And that makes complete sense. I think just in today's landscape, everyone takes to Twitter. I'm being recruited by LSU, 5-star recruit. And I get it. You shouldn't have that much foresight looking into the future because you want to enjoy the present moment. But still, you know, a lot of people, you know, you go to school and maybe the athletics doesn't work out the way you wanted. The next thing you know, you're just in some random major or something. And then it's like a scram to try and figure it out.
Well, that's the other thing, this transfer portal, right? I'm actually a fan of it in the majority's case, but it gives you an out, right? Whereas like, I really didn't have that out at Michigan, because if I would have transferred somewhere, I would have had to sit out a year. No, I didn't want to do that. So it was kind of like, you know, there was a stickiness to it. But if I was stuck at Michigan, at least I had a good degree to fall on, right? And again, that's a loose term, like a good degree. Well, what does that mean, right? I've met plenty of executives who went to, you know, like local schools.
And that's a great point. And that's, if young journalists ask me, I always tell them, like, you can go anywhere to get the sheet of paper, but it's what you do with that sheet of paper. Like, are you going to hit the ground running? Are you going to work your butt off? Are you just going to sit on the couch and eat sea salt and vinegar Lay's potato chips, which those are fantastic, by the way. I highly recommend.
I was going to say, is this sponsored by a sea
it's
salt?
It's not. Maybe we go ahead and we do it. We get the Zoltan Mesko interview sponsored by sea salt, and we get those chips for life. What do you say about that?
Perfect. Perfect. I'm all for it.
At Michigan, was it difficult to balance being a Division I football player and attending the law school of business, or did you find that to be fairly easy to manage both?
Not so easy. I guess it had to do with a little bit of sacrificing. I wish I was, I had the schedule of kind of the regular student that attended Michigan, where I could go out Tuesdays, Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays.
That sounds about right.
Right across the board. So I didn't really have that. Now the springtime is a little more loose, but you still have, spring ball. So it's not too loose, but yeah, of course, but during the season, it's such a lockdown and, you know, it equates out to a 40-hour work week, after all the travel and training, because our practices went from, I think you have to be in the building around 1:30 and then you left at 7:30. And then you went to do your homework. And of course it sucks to do your homework while you're physically exhausted. I can't even imagine with the guys that had hitting positions, right?
When you look back at your Michigan days, you guys never beat Ohio State. Is that something that upsets you to this day? Is it kind of like, whatever?
I'm glad it happened. This people can call me out on it. Like, no, you're not. But okay, like, all right, so I'll give you that. But even if 1% of me right now is being genuine that I'm glad it happened, I'm glad it happened because it really got me out of the mindset of like football is everything and your whole identity is wrapped up in it. Like, for instance, like when I got to Michigan's campus my first day, I wore a cutoff t-shirt that said, "Football is life." Chad Henne called me out in the training room. He's like, wait till like a couple months from now. And he was right. Like, yeah, never got to beat the big rival who I kept going back to for Thanksgiving, right, into the state of Ohio, and got plenty of crap for it, right? What happened? Well, it stung less and less every year, and then I started to realize that the experience that I got from Michigan from the classroom and the classmates, even friends I made outside of football, stay in touch with way more of those classmates outside of football. You know, that was really the true worth for me versus like, you know, I funny enough, I see even my age group, the recruiting class from Ohio State, they're still living in the glory days of like, do you remember when we beat Michigan for the Big Ten championship? And it's like that's all they do and talk about. And it's like, time to cut the cord, time to move on. There's more to life. And that's kind of what it made me realize. You know, it's like, if you told me I had a magic wand and to make it happen, I'd be like, yes, kick their ass 5 years in a row. Let's go. But it kind of just got what I needed, not what I wanted.
It's okay to reflect on the past, but living in it is a totally different thing. I mean, if you're living in the past, it's impossible to grow as a person. I get that. But I do understand if you had the magic wand. I was hoping you weren't going to say that you wouldn't change a thing, because I know Zoltan, if you had that wand, it would be 60-0 5 years straight.
Correct. And wouldn't you like, if you had the magic wand, to go straight to the top of broadcasting?
Of course.
Take over Monday Night Football right now.
Of course, I'd be lying to you. If I said anything other than that, I'd hope you'd call me out on this podcast.
I feel like when we're on our deathbed and we look back on it, I'm like, I'm so glad I struggled through this. And I, you know, like Adam Sandler's movie Click, where he has a remote control and he can fast forward life and he can pause it and he can mute people from arguing with him, right? It's kind of like, I wish I had that sometimes, but it's like, if I fast forwarded to, let's say, a successful time in my life, what good is that? It's kind of like waking up in someone else's shoes and it's like, oh, I was already born on third base, but I never got to experience the struggle and appreciate what it took to get here.
And that's an important message. All those moments, even when they really suck, they're so imperative to growth and just the circle of life, so to speak.
But again, as humans, we seek the easiest path, right? So I'm still lying to you if I'm telling you that that's the whole case, right? I still want to get rid of my challenges at work and whatever, life, family, like whatever it is. Like, I wish my kids didn't scream and they ate more, you know, dinner or something. I'd be lying to you if I didn't say that I wanted to fast forward through some of that stuff or get rid of it. But again, when you have distance and time, that's when you're like, okay, I'm glad it happened.
I totally get that. And you obviously were there. You redshirted your freshman year. You were there. You picked up a master's degree in sports management while at Michigan. So you get your four-year degree from Ross, master's in sports management. And again, you're still playing college football and you graduate with both. What did that mean to you and your family?
Well, it goes back to my parents were never going to have enough money to send me to a college without getting a loan out. And I was like, well, I have to earn a scholarship somewhere. So that was my number one goal. So it was huge to me that not only did I get a bachelor's degree out of it, but a master's as well. And, you know, I was unscathed with debt coming out of it because my parents came over with, you know, $10,000 in traveler's checks after having sold everything they have ever owned up to their late 30s.
And when you left the University of Michigan, did you think that you'd be drafted in the fifth round by the New England Patriots?
It was becoming more and more a reality that there might be a little bit of a future in the NFL for me. But again, my emphasis was very much on academics as well. Like even on draft day when, you know, Bob Kraft and Bill Belichick spoke to me like, hey, we're going to take you in the next pick. So congratulations, you know, get ready for practice. And I was, you know, the following week, I still had finals to take care of in my master's program. So yeah, from that standpoint, like I always kept it pretty realistic, even in the off seasons during my NFL career. I always, you know, I took an internship at a private equity firm. I did some kind of a product, consumer goods, product development boot camp through the NFL. I did a NBC Universal boot camp through the NFL. So anything that like, all right, prepare me for life after football.
That's really great that you took advantage of those opportunities and you sought out the opportunity as well. So basically you were prepared no matter what in 2010. You were ready. Football, great. If it happens, it happens. But if not, you were prepared just to move on and jump right into the real world.
Yeah, I mean, I was sort of ready. It was definitely a shock to get a, you know, sorry to use the term, big boy job, but to go into the corporate world. But yeah, I was sort of ready. I was fairly disciplined enough from college. I think the student athlete schedule calendar balance got me ready for a pretty good schedule handling. Funny enough, like when I became a professional football player, there was nothing to kind of take my mind off of football. Like if I had a bad practice, I didn't have a class to go to, right? It's kind of like, or if I got a bad grade on an exam, I didn't have practice to go to. So there was nothing to take my mind off. So it's almost like it was a blessing in disguise to be too busy in college.
So what did you do to handle that?
I think to get into those internships, I don't think I had enough like willpower to get into too many hobbies besides hanging out with friends. Yeah. Other than that, I tinkered around with building stuff a lot. Funny enough, like even when I was a youngster, college, all throughout the NFL, just, you know, kickers are weirdos. Kickers, punters are weirdos. They're always manipulating their equipment. So I feel like you just fall in line with that and kind of progresses outward. But yeah, I think I took up like some piano lessons at one point, and, you know, just anything.
Well, and you speak four different languages, Romanian, Hungarian, German, English, and you're conversational in Spanish. So is that, did some of that happen in your off time, or is that just growing up? You've learned all
that was growing up. Yeah. So ever since, you know, not practicing, those languages have all deteriorated for me. At one point I was very fluent in Spanish because it's very similar to Romanian, but you know, I'm a Hungarian who was born in Romania. So both of those languages were, you know, Hungarian and Romanian were kind of like the default. Then I went to German school because my parents kind of were like, well, if we're going to go to Germany, like, might as well put you in a German school in Romania. It's come in handy for, like, you know, some, you know, finding commonalities within relationships to be able to speak German and just riff off like some funny terms or whatever.
I want to talk about being with the Patriots, such a buttoned up from my perspective organization. What was it like playing with Tom Brady? You got Bill Belichick as a coach.
I think you used the right term there with very buttoned up and very methodical and everything's calculated. And my hat goes off to how Bill Belichick runs that place, runs that show. So my first 3 years at Michigan were with Lloyd Carr and kind of reminded me of Bill Belichick a lot, especially from the media perspective. He's like, there's no reason why we should, like, you know, run our yaps. Like, why are we giving away strategy when, like, you know, it's kind of like playing chess, right? And sometimes Bill Belichick plays chess, and sometimes the opponent just plays checkers, which is how cerebral, but also how simple he keeps it, right? Like, I think there's an art of keeping things simple, and people, like, try to overcomplicate things too much, especially in this, like, self-help era of, you know, you can find any type of book and any type of methodology and solution to your problems, like, but at the end of the day, it's like, how can you get it simple? Like, can you just not overcomplicate it with, like, oh, the, you know, 12 rules for life or the 5 second rule or like, I've read them all. And I'm just like, I can't remember one. I'll give you an example because it only makes sense, again, to keep it simple. Listen, you, Bobby, you know, I just want you to block this guy and make sure you get this shoulder. That's it, right? And I'll tell you the bigger scheme of things if you want to know, but that's where kind of the do your job mentality comes from. And he keeps it so simple, and he breaks it down like, never, ever, as a cornerback, try to deflect the ball with your near hand. You always, you know, you kind of secure the tackle with your near hand and then go with your above hand, like your farther hand, right? And you practice that like day in and day out. And funny enough, there was this drill where you carry the ball and just half speed, you tried to like strip the ball and rake it out and punch it out and anything. We always did that almost like as a warm up. And lo and behold, like our turnovers went through the roof as far as like the caused fumbles, interceptions, all that stuff. It went through the roof just because you're making it muscle memory and you're keeping it simple and you don't think about it. You're just like, it becomes innate, you know, and even like tackling drills, like lining up people on in a certain area and cones. And it's like, I'm going to run up to you and you have to maintain the right leverage. And it's kind of like, man, is this really juvenile, like middle school fundamentals BS? Then our missed tackles went down and you're like, it can't be that simple. And I remember Roger Staubach, right, Heisman Trophy winner and like 3-time Super Bowl champ with the Cowboys came in. He told us, you know, like, just do the ordinary stuff every day and people will think at an aggregate level, people will think you've achieved something extraordinary. But I never got that. And I tried to look for like the most complicated way sometimes. And I'm like, no, just like, sometimes it's just simple.
Isn't it amazing how we tend to overcomplicate everything? It blows my mind because a majority of the things, like you said, like that drill, like, it, you're thinking, why am I doing this? And then the turnovers go up. You're like, wow, like that's it. And me as an outsider, I'm thinking, oh my God, they probably drew up this brand new XZ352 play. When in reality, none of that ever happened.
Or even, oh, they use, you know, this new application that they deploy to all the players with machine learning and artificial intelligence to make sure their retinal focus is focused in more optimally into the ball and to rake it out. It's It's like, no, we literally did peewee drills.
It's crazy to think, like, you know, all of you guys as professional athletes are doing these drills that they're teaching you as a kid, but it makes sense. It really does. I want to hear about you making Bill Belichick laugh. Did you ever get him to laugh or at least maybe crack like a half smile?
Yeah. Funny enough, like people don't know. And I think reporters at this time know that, you know, that have been covering him for a number of years, that he has a comical side to him, but it's very dry humor, right? Tongue in cheek, like side of your mouth kind of laugh. But from that standpoint, we had kind of the, you know, rookies had to perform some kind of an entertainment segment or show or whatever. And I chose, you know, to do my Borat impersonation, which, you know, Sacha Baron Cohen is a genius in my perspective, especially for Borat 1. So I spoke like Borat all throughout college, funny enough. My friends had to have an intervention with me to get me to stop speaking like Borat. He still allowed me to speak like Borat when I got drunk with him. That was
amazing.
That was cool. But literally to the point of like, you know, with the Patriots, I bought myself a Borat wig, a mustache, and a mankini, right?
Oh, no.
And then that was my show, right? And I would make fun of like, you know, Tom's wife, Giselle, and like Bill O'Brien. I made fun of him. I made fun of Belichick precisely I think he still drives, maybe he switched out. He got a little cooler, but he used to drive a Volvo, like wagon, like hatchback. And, you know, I said like, what Bill Belichick drives is not the pussy magnet. Yeah, he literally came up to me after that, like, and he was laughing. He came up to me like that just because, like, his ego was kind of hurt. And he's like, you know, after people make fun of me, I usually cut them.
Dude, that's hysterical. Oh, my God, that's amazing. How could you not laugh at that?
Well, they gave me permission to entertain the team, right? So I was like, okay, you sure? All right, good. Let's go.
You met your wife with the Borat impersonation, right? Is that you went up to her with the Borat voice? That's how it all started?
Yeah, I definitely spoke to her in Borat many times. That was, again, like when it was kind of trained out of me to stop doing it sober.
Dude, that's amazing. Oh my God. I never thought in a million years. I had a hunch that you'd be good at doing a Borat impersonation, but that was spot on.
So I mean, the Patriots liked it, like the organization liked it. So to the point of like, I ran an open auction or whatever, not open auction. I was the auctioneer, you know, like going once, going twice, right? Selling off like, you know, tens of thousands of dollars worth of like value for a charity for the Patriots organization. But they're like, we need you to be in Borat. I was like, okay. It's like, this is actually paying off. Great.
That's why they drafted you, right? I don't know if you knew this, Zoltan, but I got an email saying that they drafted you solely because of the Borat impersonation skills.
It was a cherry on top, really.
You never used that on the football field, did you? You didn't ever like punt the ball and then run by somebody and say something in a Borat. You never did any of that.
No, I was too serious, funny enough. I'll go full circle with the comedic relief, right? When I stepped on the football field, it was like I meant business. And even like kicker, snapper, who you know, the triangle of faith, whatever you want to call it, like you spend all your time with them and they're like joking around in pregame. And I'm like, no, we need to like kill right now, right? Like, and they tried to snap me out of it. It was just like, no, I was taking it too seriously.
You went into protein mode.
Yes. Bro-team mode.
Bro-team mode. All about the bro-team.
Oh, there was no protein on the sidelines. I should have brought my shaker. Yeah.
Oh, my God. That would have been amazing. You have the protein shaker on the sideline. Wow.
After the punt.
So, obviously, you spent time with the Patriots for a couple of years. You went on to Pittsburgh, spent some time with the Bengals and Cincy. Once your playing career kind of started winding down, what made you decide to exit the game of football and enter the world, you know, that you were always prepared to enter?
I'll keep it simple on that thread. Why I decided to quit football is because the phone stopped ringing.
I don't know if you noticed, but I strategically asked you that question.
After the Bengals, and I did just a quick Band-Aid job for the playoff game in 2014 for them. So that after that, I was getting tryouts. I want to say like I either got like 6 or 7 tryouts. I won't be vulgar here, but I pooped my pants. Not literally, but when it was time to showcase myself. And funny enough, I did very well when there was no need for a punter, and I did very poorly in tryouts when the punter was injured for the season. Of course, there was always like, you know, 3 or 4 punters brought in. So you had to win that 3 or 4 punter competition. So I got first place, I'll call it. Anytime the punter was like slightly dinged up or monitoring his situation, and then never happened because they never needed a punter, or it was an off-season situation, I never did well, where I could have made the roster for like entering training camp. But when there was like an ACL tear or like someone broke their clavicle, right? And they needed surgery and they were out for sure. Never did well.
Why that was the case? Any reason, any insight?
Not sure. Just kind of worked out that way, I guess. But maybe it was, I think a lot of things in life are mental too, right? Like even when I was out of football as a free agent, like when I was not with a team, I desperately wanted to get back on a team. And then when I got a call to fly out for a tryout, when they brought me in, for some reason at that point, I stopped wanting to be in football. Like just, you know, in that 6 or 7 separate times, I was like, oh, I want to be on a team. No, I'm kind of nervous. Probably like fear of failure, right? I couldn't get out of my head. And now, again, hindsight 2020, funny enough, when the tryout was over, that spiked right after. I'm talking right after, like, as soon as I, like, put my jeans back on to, like, wait for, like, the final word if I made the team or not. That's when I was like, I hope I make it, right? But during that tryout, I was kind of like, oh, I'm so done with this. It was so weird. It was kind of like self-sabotaging myself. I don't know how to describe it, but.
Do you think some of it had to do with your aspirations outside of football? Because from my perspective, that always seemed to be on the table.
No, I'll follow that thread because there's some truth to it. I was like, again, going back to the identity wrapped up in football, I kind of like, I didn't like the stigma of like dumb football player. So I always like tried to do better at that, especially in like in the classroom in college. And then when kind of that proving ground went away, when I could be like, oh, look at my exam score. Looks like I did better than you. And I'm a dumb jock, you know, like, so I took a lot of pride in that. But then when that went away in the NFL, somehow I like lost a way to like prove that I was like more than just a football player. Right. I don't know if that makes sense or not.
Do you think you really had to prove anything though?
It was all mental. Right. And it's like, well, then you break it down. Where it's like, well, what's the point of life? Well, it's to be intellectual and make something of yourself. Well, it's like, well, what does that mean? Because does it matter in the end? Like, not really. Like, right? Like, Shakespeare, to quote Shakespeare, nothing is as fleeting as fame, right? The day you die is, or the day you retire is the day people start forgetting you. Like, funny enough, like, perfect example. Drew Bledsoe, who I believe might make the Hall of Fame or is in the Hall of Fame, I know he's in the Patriots Hall of Fame, didn't come about Twitter until I started playing. He was retired by then. I had more followers. I still have more followers, I think, than Drew Bledsoe. How's that possible? Because people started forgetting about him, right? You kind of like get forgotten into irrelevancy.
People wrap your identity with football or one singular thing, when in reality, like that shouldn't define somebody. That's a part of you, but it is not you as a person. And I think that's the challenging part, not just for athletes, but for maybe broadcasters who get out of broadcasting and then they go into something else.
I will tell you, like, a thought that raced through my mind a lot was I extrapolated or projected into the future a lot. Because I was, you know, my second year, I was second in the league in net punting average. So I was like, oh my God, this could be a 10 to 15 year career. So I extrapolated into the future and I'm like, I'm going to retire close to 40 years old. Then what? I'm sure I would have found something, but I was kind of afraid of that. And it, you know, it goes back to like irrational fears that are like based in no evidence whatsoever.
In some ways, I feel like it's almost human nature. How could you not have some sense of fear? Like, oh, what am I going to do after, when you've dedicated yourself to one thing in particular for so many years?
Yeah, yeah. And it's funny, like our problems, no matter what they are, we always find problems, right? Like even if you don't have, even if you don't have financial problems, you evolve to make problems for yourself. Almost like as humans, we always find a way to like, make something, conjure up some type of a challenge.
I do it all the time. I hate it. It's the worst. I always look back the next day. I'm like, really? I just put 9 roadblocks in front of me when I didn't have to have anything.
Can you use an example just to kind of cross interview you? I want to learn.
You have like your day, right? It's simplified. You wake up, you eat breakfast, you have your meetings. And then I'm like thinking about, well, if this meeting runs late and then I'm interviewing this person and it's like, and I've allowed myself like 3 hours in between. And then this like irrational thinking starts taking place. Like, well, if it runs late, then how am I going to contact the other person? And then you're not even in that moment. That's like one roadblock. And then that just kind of goes downhill from there, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I'm following. And the other thing I think about is like, whether you're growing up in, you know, white picket fence, American dream lifestyle, and like, in, let's say, a war-torn country, somewhere in the Middle East, let's call it, right, or Africa, your level of whatever serotonin, dopamine, or, you know, cortisol, the stress hormone, that spike is literally the same amount in America or your life in, like, war-torn country, right? And that's why it's like, it's almost like dodging bombs and getting rejected from your hot date causes the same amount of like stress. It's ridiculous. And that's why we kind of have to step back sometimes, you know, going full circle. Sometimes I forget where I came from.
You hit on it. It's about perspective. You know, in those moments, I think, especially the older we get, or at least you hope that you can step outside and really look and be like, wow, really? You know, and then use that moving forward. So once football ended, was there a limbo period where you just kind of hung around for a little while trying to figure out, you know, which, like, whether you wanted to be an entrepreneur, whether you wanted to join an existing company?
I think my mentor had lined things up for me a long time ago. Literally, he just chose my field. He's like, you're going to be great in sales and tech, B2B, you know, business to business. And very respected mentor. Like, he did very well in his technology sales career. He was the chief revenue officer at Gartner Research, like took him from 25 million in sales to like 2 billion. Right. So I'm like, I'm going to listen to you. But from that perspective, I did dabble in the startup world, in the entrepreneurship world. I, you know, hope to one day own my own business, but I really like what I'm doing even today. Like, I don't, you know, hate it, right? It's like, it allows me the really good lifestyle kind of work-life balance, right? Where it's like, yeah, you might not like doing this task, but you can reward yourself. Like, you have enough time in the day to think of some reward that you can give to yourself.
So now you're an account executive at Snowflake. It's a cloud-based data warehousing company. What do you do on a day-to-day basis? What does a day-to-day in Zoltan Mesko's life look like now?
Yeah, just business development, sales, right? Trying to get people to adopt this cloud data platform that we're selling. It's been really exciting to be a part of the company because I saw, you know, the pre-IPO days, and we IPO'd back in September. Funny enough, Warren Buffett has invested in 2 pre-IPO companies, one being Ford in 1957 and Snowflake in 2020. So I like saying that. It's kind of cool. And we had the biggest IPO of any technology company in the history of the stock market, right? Bigger than Microsoft. So really exciting to be a part of the on the train, I should say.
Do you find yourself being able to take things you learned from your football career and essentially marrying the two with what you're doing now over at Snowflake?
Yeah, and not even more so the successes that it brought me, like, oh, I should do this because hard work pays off and, you know, it's going to pay dividends. But it's more so like, don't act this way because it'll benefit you better. I see the parallel right now. Don't do what you did before. Do it this way, right? So I feel like just process of elimination in life is so much more powerful than finding a rule that you can stick to, because there's so many more nuances. Like, you kind of like find, I think, funny enough, Matthew McConaughey has some quote like this, that, you know, it's like, just try enough things and you know what you don't want to be or don't want to do or shouldn't do, right?
Do you miss football at all?
I miss the part, I think this is too cliche, I miss the part with the players in the locker room, right? Being Borat, entertaining. But I get to entertain with dad jokes with clients, right? There's plenty of times where it's like, that was close to an HR violation, but don't hold it against me, guys.
Are you, that's too funny that you're dropping the dad jokes, but with your clients, especially if they have a family, they're going to understand it. And that's a nice, I think it's a good connectivity point, because you don't, even though that we're both in corporate America, you don't want to be so corporate to the point where like people are like, wow, like this dude is stuffy right now.
No, you got to show your human side a little bit.
Yeah. Right. There has to be a healthy, just something that we talked about earlier, something that the two of us work on. There has to be a healthy balance.
There's nothing wrong with dad jokes if you yourself recognize that it's a terrible joke. It's like, I'm self-aware. That was a honest to God terrible joke. And it's so corny, so cheesy, but at least I got you to smile. So that's good. I broke the ice. I really enjoyed the conversation, Colin. Appreciate you you having me on. So thank you.
Yeah, absolutely, dude. Really appreciate the time. And let's obviously keep in touch. And if you and the family ever find yourselves in Los Angeles, let me know. Dinner on me. Or if I find myself in Cleveland, I'll wear an Ohio State jersey. I'm kidding, I won't. But we definitely got to keep in touch, dude. Thank you.
Sounds good. Take care, Colin.
For more amazing stories of former athletes, check out Hey Where'd You Go on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and a video version on YouTube. Plus, don't forget to check it out on social media. That's @ Colin Kushner on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.